Okay, so let's continue then. Some people were asking what my new job is, because I'm just starting in a couple weeks. So that's what it is. That's what I'll be, an associate director for science at SOPHiA. So I'm going to talk about zodiacal light possibilities. Let's see. Let me try this one. Good. Yeah, in a couple weeks. Not NASA, right, USRA. Let's see, so as for why we're interested in the smaller bodies, i.e. smaller than the planets, is, and Carl already mentioned this first fact, which is that they're a tracer of the gravitational potential, as in Saturn's rings, and they can tell you about the dynamical architecture of the system. They are the material that, well, that's the kind of material that we can actually retrieve and study in the lab in the solar system. And the small particles in early evolution of planetary systems and later is a source of transport of material during the formation of the planets and in extermination of the dinosaurs and such events. So with just a generic couple slides, I put I like to show about small bodies and the two kinds inside and outside the snow line, as you guys all know, the devolatilized material in the inner solar system and the icy outside. Say it again?
What kind of
star? Yeah, it's not really. 5AU for all stars, of course. That's. Yeah, and even for G, it's not really 5AU, and it changes with age. Yeah. I'll put a tilde in front of that next time, because you're not the first person to ask me that. But that, then what happens to that stuff later? So where is it now? And something I just like to emphasize is that it's all over the place. So the zodiacal cloud might be mostly or largely cometary, and it's in the inner solar system. There's cometary and asteroidal material deposited on the surfaces of all the terrestrial planets. There's rocky material in the cores of the ice giants, et cetera. I don't want to, it's not a theoretical talk, so I want to get to the more observational details. So this is a picture of the zodiacal light made by IRAS at 12, 25, and 60 microns, color image. And these data changed our knowledge of the zodiacal cloud very significantly, because for the first time we could see structures in the zodiacal light. So these horizontal bands, and here, as well as these thin diagonal stripes, for the first time connected the cloud to individual parent bodies. The diagonal stripes were associated with individual short period comets, and the horizontal bands were associated with asteroid families. Okay.
I'm sorry, is this a 360 degree
model? It's 90.
Oh, because it looks very uniform.
Yeah, it's like 90 by 60.
If you had done this as a 360 degree, I mean, I realize you can't look right into the sun, but.
Well, this was made roughly with Terminator, with quadrature observations, as IRAS went around the sky. So you actually can make this with 360 degrees, but it's as seen always at quadrature.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Look, you can see an S shape due to the inclination of the dust bands if you do that. Okay, let's see. Yes, I'll show another in a second, but not with anywhere near this quality. WISE will be fantastic. I've seen some of the, over people's shoulders, I've seen some of the WISE images. So a WISE image might be about this big, and it had some trails in it. So it's serendipitously seeing structures, and its sensitivity is high. It's not higher than IRAS for surface brightness, right? Way higher for point sources. But yes, the images look like that. So WISE will repeat. But for the very large scale structure like these asteroid bands, I don't know if they're going to survive the image processing in WISE, which takes out a flat field from each image.
That stripe across the center is not just an artifact of the intensity versus something.
No, it's not an artifact. This is real. So this.
You said that twice, and I just didn't.
It's okay. So this one It's actually two pairs. There's one here, and then down, there's one here. Yeah, so that's, they're at plus and minus a certain latitude. And so those are two individual asteroid families make these. And then this stripe here plus this stripe here are at plus and minus the same latitude, and those are due to another asteroid family. So there's three known, and there's another up at 17, which you can't see so clearly in this one. All right, here's a repeat. This is these are images from COBE now. The COBE images are a repeat of zodiacal light measurements, and the quality of these for large scale emission was even much higher than IRAS, but it only had 1 degree angular resolution, whereas the IRAS had 2 arc minute. So they each bring their stories. So IRAS tied the zodiacal light to parent bodies for the first time. And what COBE did was provide these very high quality, all sky as visible to COBE images. All right, the zodiacal light as seen from 1AU, it's the main source of sky brightness, as you guys all know. So the sun is in the middle in this image, and this is made from 1 month worth of COBE data in its spinning orbit, the galactic plane, and then this is the zodiacal light sticking out of each side of the solar avoidance hole.
Yeah, on that one, I'm sorry to keep interrupting, but this is so interesting. I don't see bands, well, I barely see any hint of any linear structures in that. That looks very,
yeah. So the first order, and looking from far away, the cloud is very, very smooth. So now I made a very simple model for the zodiacal cloud, a very symmetric and smooth cloud, and then subtracted that. And then that's what this is. That's just that same image minus a symmetric, smooth, tilted zodi cloud. And so now, well, the Milky Way comes out better, obviously. Now you can see the bands. There they are. So in the IRAS image, it was about like this in size. And it had those same, that's the same, this is the plus and minus 10 degree bands, and then these you can't resolve with COBE are the four little bands near the ecliptic. All right, so the resolution was bad, but the large scale structure was very good, and so now we could see these features, which are enhancements in the Earth's orbit. So when we're looking tangent to the Earth's orbit, there's enhancements. So that's how we discovered the ring, circumsolar ring of dust, which I'll talk more about later. Let's see, but first I want to talk about the origin of the particles a little bit. If you look at the brightness profile, make a slice like this. It's a factor of 10. Oh yeah, you can't, it's all digitized, but yeah. Yeah. These are at 25 microns. So now let's talk about that. Yeah, now let's talk about that. So now we just know there's a bunch of light, right? So if you make the brightness profile and then you compare it to the predicted vertical profiles due to different parent populations, that's what, from this theoretical paper by Nesvorny et al., he said if the particles are all due to Halley-type comets, that's HTC, Jupiter family comets or asteroids, these are the vertical distributions that are predicted. And then the black line is observed. So what you can see is that the distribution of the zodiacal light is too fat to be all asteroidal. It's too wide. And it's far too narrow to be all due to Halley-type comets. And obviously for Oort cloud comets, it would be isotropic, so it's not that either. So these data strongly point towards an origin, a cometary origin for the bulk of the zodiacal cloud. And so he came up with a number of greater than 90%.
Does he take into account, do they take into account redistribution? I mean, does his model say, okay, here's orbits, and therefore the stuff gets deposited at a certain place, and that produces that vertical profile? Or does he take into account what I assume would be redistribution by solar pressure?
He does gravity and solar, gravity and solar pressure, and perturbations. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So we should do it.
Okay. Yeah. I believe it. It doesn't do comminution. It doesn't do collisions. But it's, yeah, I don't know either.
So the conclusion is that most of what you see comes from the Duker family?
Yes, 90%. And if you read, he also put in the teaser that he also says that most carbonaceous chondrite meteorites are cometary, which is cool. So there was the interplanetary dust community, an interstellar dust community. So there's been a series of workshops spaced by every couple years. So at the one that was in Kauai about 5 years ago, we did a poll. Oops, sorry, I'm shining the laser on you. We did a poll, and there's like 150 people there. It's a lot of people, and we came up with 50-50. And I think that if it was done like 5 years before that, it probably would have been mostly asteroidal. So it, exactly. So let me try and explain why. And then if you went back 20 years, you would say, everyone would have said it's all cometary. So here's the reason that it evolved. I'll explain it. So it's a temporary bump. The asteroidal, if you look in history, the asteroidal contribution went up. And it's for the following reason. The IRAS images clearly show the horizontal structures due to the asteroid families. And the fantastic work has shown that it's actually individual young asteroid families that have done this. All right, so in this paper by Dan Derda, he was calculating, well, we know how many asteroids are in asteroid families, and we know that they make a certain amount of dust because we can see their signature. So one can then use that to extrapolate what the entire cloud would be. So he took the size, he made the size distribution of family asteroids and all asteroids, and then he came up, if they were producing dust at a certain rate according to a collision model, then he said that the entire belt would be 3.4 times the family contribution. So if you took the family contribution of the from the IRAS dust bands and multiplied it by 4.4, one plus this, then you get a large fraction of the cloud. Then you get like 50% of the cloud. So that's how that calculation went. It was an honorable calculation. The error was only realized much later, and it's the fact that not only are random asteroids less efficient at making dust or have a lower collision rate than family asteroids, but even family asteroids are almost irrelevant compared to the very recent collisions of small ones. So here, actually from their paper, it was a prediction of it. The time history of the dust over a whole solar system history, and then here's a little blow up of a bit of it. Okay, well, a little bit over here, and so it's punctuated with these individual. Yes. Yeah, I know. So there it is. So there might be some floor in quiescent times, but so each of these would be a collision of an individual 10 to 50, or the most recognizable ones, kilometer diameter asteroid.
So are you saying that you still buy this picture?
I think that yes. And so what we see
from years ago, this picture.
So we see three dust band pairs, maybe four. So all we need is three or four of these peaks to, they don't have to be at the peak, three or four of the exponential tails of these to coexist. And, you know, just eyeballing, that's not a ridiculous number. The only part of this that's wrong is the floor. And so the asteroids in less dense parts of phase space don't produce as much dust. So this, the hair part is right, but the floor, the efficiency of dust production by is lower for random asteroids. Oh, yes. Yeah, that's a good question. I wish I knew that off the top of my head. But let me just guess and say that it's not too far above this floor, because they tuned it to the observations. Yeah, and they did not say that we're at a spike. All right, and then other evidence for increases in the amount of dust in the past were from the deep sea sediments in these papers by Ken Farley. and they measure the amount of rare isotopes in the deep sea sediments versus their history, and they see a couple of peaks, and they associate them with individual asteroid collisions in the past. So this is if this could be done perfectly, this plot should look like that previous one, which would be awesome. These are the recent asteroid collisions that have been identified. This is whether they have a feature in the IRAS image. All right, so this is the origin of the 1.4 degree band, the 2.1 degree band, and the 9.3 degree bands. And there's their associated asteroid family. Okay, and this is from the Ken Farley papers about Chesapeake Bay being associated with that. Okay, so this just shows that there's a handful of these and gives their ages. I wanted to get those numbers up there. All right, so what kind of stuff can we do from a space probe? The main problem of observations from one location is that you're only ever observing the integral along the line of sight, and that's not readily inverted into the volume density, which is what you want to know. The inner zodiac light was very well measured by a mobile space probe, which was Helios. The Helios probe, a German experiment, had an orbit that took it from 0.3 to 1 AU, and it did that many times. I forgot how many, maybe 12 times. These are, and there were two of them, two twin spacecraft. It's a great experiment. And these are just the data versus time after they normalized it by a power law. So you could, if there's any fine scale structure of the zodiacal light, it should show up as peaks in here. So we know radially that it's pretty smooth. This is the main source of believed data on the radial distribution of the zodiacal cloud. Is really this experiment. We all rely on that. All right, so now let me describe an experiment that I did, which was trying to study a small radial enhancement due to the resonant structure with the Earth. I showed you in the COBE image that there was the enhancement in brightness when you're looking ahead and behind the Earth's orbit. Okay, the Earth ring is that. This is a theoretical model for it. With the sun in the middle and the Earth here, and it's predicted that there's an enhancement behind us and then a ring that fills. And the particles that have orbits that bring them too close to the Earth are more violently scattered out. So the predictions are a gap near the Earth and maybe a bigger enhancement behind than in front and a ring.
What's the argument about asymmetry?
The leading versus trailing asymmetry? Only the exterior resonances are stable, the interior ones are not, and that's as far as I'm going to go with the explanations. If the interior ones would be here, but they're not stable. All right, so so what we did here was we used the Spitzer spacecraft, which was another example of doing observations from a mobile platform. So it has traveled now very far from Earth. It's much more than half an AU away from Earth now. If you look at, here's in a co-moving rest frame with the Earth here at 0-1. This is the trajectory of Spitzer, and so now it's out here. And that means that if there's a change in brightness along the Earth's orbit over this arc here, then we can detect it by doing the sky brightness observations. So that's what we're looking for. These are the observations. These are calibration data using the infrared camera, what I used to work on, looking straight up. All right, for a few years, and you see an annual variation. That's due to the tilt of Spitzer's orbit with respect to the dust cloud, as well as the eccentricity of Spitzer's orbit with respect to the eccentricity period. Okay, so to first order, it's a sinusoid, but then we knew that, so we subtract that out. You just fit a simple sinusoid to that, and then you get these residuals. So anything over and above the sinusoid would be an asymmetry along the Earth's orbit. So this is what we see. We see what looks like a low brightness, a high brightness, a low brightness again, and about the same. So we think that this is that predicted trailing blob following the Earth, and there it is. It's radial. Well, it's azimuthal structure measured for the first time. Yeah.
Do you think this observation is part of the science program or part of the engineering?
Engineering. Well, technically, the calibration is part of the science program, but then you, if you break it out again, it's from the calibration budget. Not the, it was not by proposal. There were proposals to do this too. Actually, this is from, these were the proposal data, the crappy ones, but the these are the calibrations.
Is that state
of
power?
Yeah. It didn't work
so
that well.
Blob, the number I remember is it's like 10% of the background. Was that consistent with, after you subtract out the science part?
That's about right. So we can even just do it right here. It was about 0.1 compared to 7. Or 0.1 compared to 7.5.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's another thing we can do. We can do that for the first time. All right. So observations by space probes. So, so I told you about Helios measuring some radial asymmetries, Spitzer measuring some azimuthal asymmetries. To go outside of 1AU, there were the zodiacalite was measured by Pioneer 10, and so that's the only believable data on the radial structure outside. And they also get a power law. But there's a lot, there's a beyond where the zodiacalite photometer could detect the zodiacalite is unknown territory. So the entire outer solar system is quite open and unknown. Let's see. Do I want to do that? One thing, yeah, let me do just a tiny bit on this. One thing that we know about the inner planetary dust is, well, we can measure its composition by mass spectrometers on spacecraft and its sizes. That's something that you don't know for exozodiacal systems pretty much ever, except by inference, but it can be directly measured in some cases with spacecraft. And one that did that was Stardust when it flew through the coma of Comet Vild 2. And measured it using a number of different kinds of detectors, including acoustic sensors and the solar shields and attitude changes and the of the spacecraft. So the very largest particle that hit it was 30 milligrams that actually jogged the attitude. And so the size distribution that you get out of that, the main reason I'm putting this part in is because I wanted to show this. This is the size distribution of the input to the zodiacal cloud from comets, from a comet. I just want to emphasize that it's not a power law, okay? It's clearly not a power law. It's piecewise, you know, there's two obvious sections that might be power laws. But if you were to just assume a power law and you're only sensitive to small particles, the typical particles that are dominating surface area, and extrapolate that, you'll get the wrong total mass by order of magnitude. So I just want to harp on, that's my soapbox fact, is no power law for its particle size distribution.
Well, it is below a certain size, which may say that power law talks about the ground up stuff.
Yes.
The bigger chunks don't obey that rule.
Yeah, so if you wanted to say what's the total mass and what you really know is the surface area of these, you can't just take some index, right, Q or something, which is the normal thing, and then turn that into a total mass. You'll be off by this discrepancy. All right, and then I put in some representative numbers, and you can get the mass in the large particles in the area and the small. And in some cases, in some cases, you actually have both the mass and surface area from the large grains. And that was the case for Comet Encke. This is an image with ISOCAM. And then we did dynamical models for ejecting particles from Comet Encke of different, for particles of different size, and you can see they make very different images. And so you can tell by eye, there's the image, you can tell what the particle size is. They're certainly not dominated by 100 micron particles. They must be all mostly larger than that, and certainly not this. So the particle sizes are centimeter sized, and that's because this is sensitive to surface area. Unless for some reason centimeter sized particles are superheated, that's in some cases the particles coming straight out of the comets are large, are centimeter sized. All right, just a little bit on the zodiacal light spectrum. Again, to say that large particles tend to dominate. There's the spectrum of the zodiacal light in the mid-infrared. This is from this is also from ISOCAM. This is from 5 to 16 microns. And to first order, the spectrum's pretty smooth. But if you subtract out a black body, then you do get a hump here, which we associate with the SIO stretching mode of silicates. Paper about that. So there's a small contribution from small particles, I guess is what that comes down to. All right. So the outer zodiacal light. Jamie already talked about our conference. You guys know all about our 5AU workshop. And I want to talk about the outer zodiacal light, because this is the real estate where we can make the most contribution from a future space probe, where it's pretty much unknown. So in a pioneering paper by Luzuk and Dermott, they started particles out from Kuiper belt-like object orbits, and then determined their fate, what happens to them. And a certain fraction make it into the inner solar system, a certain fraction are ejected by the planets as they pass. And they also found that interstellar dust might be a main loss mechanism for these particles, because it's coming through the solar system at 26 kilometers per second and can shatter the particles before they reach the inner solar system. And another pioneering paper by Mauro Martin and Malhotra, they did very similar calculations, a little more detail, and they matched the they made models that match the amount of dust detected by the Pioneer detectors, particle detectors in the outer solar system. So these are normalized now to a measurement. And from that, they could infer the mass of dust that would be from the Kuiper belt. And I was able to use those models to try and make predictions of what we might see for an outer solar system probe. So now what I'm doing is, this is the predicted polar. So let's say we're doing an experiment where we have a photometer on an outer solar system probe and it's looking straight up. And what's the polar brightness as we move out to the outer solar system? We've been previously just assuming some power law, extrapolating that. So now I change the model to include a torus of dust. And that shows what one certain kind of torus might look like. And here's, if we're observing in the plane, but in the anti-solar direction, what the brightness might be looking like. So these are the kinds of signals that we're looking for. But that was just for some Gaussian torus. If I take something that looks much more like the Mauro Martin and Malhotra results, it's much wider distribution and a much higher contribution to the sky brightness. So the main sky brightness out at 10 AU, out at Saturn, is almost certainly from this Kuiper belt dust. But we don't know this within factor of few. All right, so just jotting down some notes about how these observations of these the Kuiper belt dust relates back to the history of solar system. And we already did this. We had a good discussion of this yesterday, I think. That the fact that the scattered disk in the Kuiper belt exists, and that the Plutinos exist with and their relative populations, it sets strong constraints on the history of the major planet orbits. All right. So the shape of the Kuiper belt, the Kuiper belt itself, and the KB, the Kuiper belt dust relates to the recent collisions. So it will have ramifications also for the planetary system architecture. It's the same. The dust will fill all the dynamical niches, just like the Kuiper belt objects themselves did as a result of the migration.
I thought you just established that, at least in the inner solar system, that the zodiac was from these Jupiter family comets. And now you tell me at 10 AU it's from the Kuiper belt.
Correct.
So it switches.
Yes.
Okay.
So what has to happen? Well, we don't know it to within a factor of few, but the. This is a brightness. This is a brightness prediction. So the difference between these two is the Kuiper belt contribution. All right. So maybe it makes some contribution at 1 AU, but not much.
Okay. And the straight line was the cometary contribution.
Yes.
Okay. and there are data points that
data points
are closer to the upper line than the lower line. Is that?
Well, there's data points that only go out to here, 1, 2, 3, 3.5, that go out to here.
Okay.
All right, and you have a power law. And so actually, maybe those data already constrain this very fat model that I have here. In terms of zodiacal light brightness, but in terms of particle detection of micron-sized particles, actually submicron particles, 10 to the minus 12 gram particles, they see a distribution that's flat with radius. So that's what the Moreau-Martin and that's what the Kuiper belt models are all normalized to. So there are data points that definitely, well, yeah, the particles look pretty much like this dotted curve, in fact. They go flat all the way out to Saturn. All right, so as you also have seen, we're interested in doing space measurements, and on Jamie's instrument, that instrument concept, we'd be observing in the near infrared and looking at the zodiacal light as it changes from 1.135, and if it goes out to Saturn, to 10 AU, and looking for the cosmological signals. We'll measure the diffuse galactic light if we look in the near infrared. And then that experiment actually had several components. One of them was doing these observations in this wavelength range from 1 to 5 microns. And there's a little bit of it that they put in for me, which is a wide field optical camera. And this is the one that could make images similar to the IRAS image. So it has 5 arc minute pixels, similar to the IRAS, and an 85 degree field of view. So it's sort of similar in my dreams. The images would be, let me flip all the way back. The images would be not too different from this, all right? But we would be doing it for the outer solar system. Would look the other way. So instead of seeing asteroid dust bands, if they exist, we'd see Kuiper belt dust bands. So that's the dream. Oh. Yes, it's an animation. Right, I'm pretty much at the end, so go ahead and start thinking of questions. In the near infrared, if we did Jamie's experiment and we measured spectra, then we might also be able to measure composition of the particles. And this is something that, in principle, could eventually be done for exozodiacal light as well, to get its near infrared spectrum. It's incredibly hard, but in principle, can be done. And the great thing about this is we should see the change from asteroidal and Jupiter family cometary material out to more icy and volatile rich material. As we go out into the outer solar system. These are observations. I don't think Jamie highlighted these, but these are from his rocket experiment, Cyber, cosmic background experiment. And there's data points here that show a reflectance feature in the zodiacal light. So there's much, much higher amplitude. It's a much more prominent feature than the emission one that I was showing at 10 microns. So this has been associated. It matches a wide range of pyroxene minerals. Well, actually, it's this feature, yeah, that we also see in reflectance spectra of asteroids. Okay. And just to drive home, when we're doing composition of Zodi cloud, we also can collect, we have laboratory samples of those materials, so we can do ground truth. So I like to think of zodiacolite as sort of a ground truth for exozodiacolite, but then even from that, we can go one step further and go into the laboratory and study this material in detail. Yeah.
We must have spectra of the zodiacal light.
This is the first one.
That's the first one?
Yeah, there's a new result. It's not even published yet.
I mean, all these years, and the zodiacal light is so bright, well, relatively speaking, we don't have spectra that go
no.
out to the infrared.
No, diffuse emission I'm lying. In this wavelength range, there is a spectrum that goes from 2 microns out.
There's the infrared.
By IRTS.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have features.
But going in, I've always assumed that it was sort of a straight line going down into the visible and ultraviolet.
That's the reflectance would be just
seeing the dip there. That's
I think everyone was.
Okay.
Yeah, because that's like a 50% deep feature. It's a linear scale. I think everyone was.
Pyroxene is a mineral?
A very common silicate mineral. Yeah. Although, okay. We always get from other measurements, we always infer olivine.
So the fact
surprised.
That there's a feature there also says that these particles are a little bit larger than micron size because they were micron size.
It's not an emission feature, it's a reflectance feature, and it's, even a whole asteroid gives it. So we're seeing, probably on this interplanetary dust particle, we're seeing its reflectance due to a tiny layer in the surface even of the particle. Yeah, so it's not as sensitive to size. I know what you're saying, but it's not emission, it's just reflectance. Okay. And I think that's it. This is just a reminder of Jamie's instrument proposal. That's it.
Any questions?
Here.
Where is the smallest particle? Maybe you don't answer it. That's got that very unique silicate feature.
Yeah.
That's sort of typical submicron-sized particles.
Yeah.
But is that just a very tenuous, insignificant tail of things that are transient?
It's the feature is broad, so either the material is almost all amorphous. It looks like there might be a small crystalline peak in the spectrum. Not the world's easiest thing to see. In which case, there would be some submicron particles. But I think you can make it with even just micron-sized particles. All right, and so we know that there's submicron. All right, so the question is just whether you believe that. It's not very prominent, but that would indicate that there's small crystalline particles.
Thinking simplistically about how we've been treating extrasolar debris disks, what would you say that an amin value would be for the dust size distribution in the solar system?
We see them down to 10 to the minus 18 grams.
Right,
there's actual data.
We have a sensitivity to see things that are really small, but is the bulk of the population cutting off at the naive calculation of the blowout size for a G2 star?
Well, they exist. They're just going out, right? So those are the beta meteoroids. And so they're seen by the Helios particle detectors, not the zodiacal light experiment I was talking about, but they're seen by the particle detectors, and you just see them moving radially outward from the sun. So yeah, those are the ones that are down at 10 to the minus 18 grams. So you can't just nuke them. But like in Kate Sue's models, she has the blowout particles included. So I think it's not inconsistent with that. You just can't set them to zero. Yeah.
What's the azimuthal variability of the Zodi? I mean, if you're thinking of like a TPF and you're trying to follow a planet going along and you want to interpret changes in brightness as being due to the, you know, phase variations of the planet.
Yeah. I would say that these are about as good a data as we have. It's these Helios data. So it's drawing an ellipse from 0.3 to 1 AU, all right? And then now we've taken out the radial factor. So it's not 360 degrees of azimuth, but along its orbit, we see a very low, and then you want me to put a number on it, which I'll do after I sit down, of what the amplitude of these are. Most of these artifacts are due to stars and coronal events.
And is it time variable at all?
And then the other thing they did, also from this experiment, which was a great experiment, I didn't realize I was going to trumpet this so much, but it lasted for 11 years, so they measured the brightness before and after. So in a 1981 paper by Leinert, he was the PI of this, he set an upper limit to the time variability. It was very strict. It was like a percent over 10 years. It was a very strict limit. So there is a reference you can have for the time stability, a measured time stability of zodiacal light, but it would be from these guys.
The caption says that the divisions are 5% on the left scale, if I can see them.
Yeah,
those divisions. So it looks like the fluctuations here are less of 5 and maybe 10%.
Less.
It's pretty smooth going out
on yeah.
the scale.
And a lot of that's probably artifact. That would be ideal. A face-on view of the solar system from above, I don't know about ideal, but that would be a very good way of measuring the radial structure, obviously, and rings. So yeah, we considered that, you know, and when we were doing Chaz's mission proposal in 1996, we considered vertical trajectories as well. They're just too expensive. But Ulysses did it, as you said, and if there were an optical camera on it, it could have done that. It would have been great.